So you'll have to tell me. Do you need, I was occurring to me, this is my first lecture of the day, and so I was imagining, inserting a joke midway, but you've just been at the end of two lectures this morning, some of you. Are you burned out enough that you need a double dose today, or do you? The answer was yes? Okay, well, so I stress that especially since we're double dipping today, the jokes will be of even more questionable humorousness than normal, within yesterday's precedent. So the man gets the man gets on the train, and he sits down again, and there is that second man again. He's sitting across from him, and he's holding a banana in each ear, and so. First guy says, why are you doing that? And second guy doesn't answer at all. And first guy says, why are you doing that? And the second guy says, oh, you'll have to speak up. I have bananas in my ears. Okay. Anyway, that's the best I got. The next one, okay. Okay, so last time we learned everything that there is to know about differential geometry. And this time I propose to just take you through the derivation, now that we've laid that groundwork, take you through the derivation of the Einstein-Hilbert action, the action for gravity, for general relativity, in parallel with the derivation of the Yang-Mills action, the action for the non-abelian gauge field, to see that they're very closely, to emphasize what is parallel about them, in case you haven't seen that or thought about that. And then at the end, if we have time, I'll then explain how you derive the Einstein equations from that action. And then that will be, roughly speaking, the review of general relativity, and starting at the next lecture, which I remind you is Thursday, for me. We'll take one lecture to basically cover every metric that you really need to know, and see that they're all very closely related to one another and what their basic geometrical properties are. Okay, but so before I go ahead, let me just give a 2-minute review of what we did last time. So, the idea was to present the structure of differential geometry in three steps, where first we just had a manifold with no structure on it apart from the fact that it was this space where if we zoomed in enough at any point, if it was an m-dimensional manifold, near any point it looked like Rm. M-dimensional Euclidean space, and we were already then able to have this idea that we could choose different coordinates in which to describe the points on the manifold and the objects that live in the vicinity of those points or above those points, and we had the notion of tensors. So we defined tensors as being objects that transformed in a particular way under a coordinate transformation. And the motivation for how they transformed, intuitively, the transformation law for each upper index is the same as the transformation law for the coefficients in a directional derivative, the coefficients that constitute the linear combination of derivatives in a directional derivative in a particular direction, and the requirement that derivative at some point be meaningful regardless of what coordinates you write it down in. And similarly, the transformation law for each lower index intuitively was the transformation law that if you had a little differential element dx mu c mu with coefficients in the linear combination given by c mu, how should these c mus change so that the little infinitesimal vector, if you will, defined by that linear combination is invariant, it has geometrical meaning regardless of what coordinates you describe it in. Okay, and then we said step two. So at the moment we have a little vector space living over each point, and it's basically the space of tangent vectors to the manifold at that point. So it's there's a little tangent space at every point on the manifold, but so far the tangent space around that lives above this point is essentially disconnected from the tangent space that lives above this point. And we changed that by introducing a connection on the manifold, which is essentially a way to, one way that we motivated it was by saying it's a thing that you use to modify the partial derivative, to convert a partial derivative into a covariant derivative, so that the covariant derivative, so roughly speaking, we added this connection, and it had the property, it was designed to have the property that now, when I take a covariant derivative of a tensor, I get a new tensor. The new object also transforms like a tensor, but just with one more lower index. And once I had that, suddenly I had a notion of what it meant to parallel transport tensors around on the manifold. And so I could say whether, given two points and a curve connecting them, I could say whether a vector or a tensor at this living in this tangent space here or in its dual space. I should say you can think of the, you know, with the vector space. There's a tangent space in which contravariant vectors live in a dual to the tangent space, cotangent space, in which the covariant vectors or let's say covariant indices live. Anyway, so now we have a notion of, given two points and a curve, whether a vector what it means to parallel transport a vector from this tangent space over to this tangent space, or what it means for these two guys for a pair of vectors in two different tangent spaces to be parallel or perpendicular to one another, or parallel to one another, I should say. At this step two, once we had a connection, we also had a special curves, geodesics, that had the property that they parallel transported their own tangent vectors. Their own tangent vectors were examples of things that were parallel transported along the curve. And finally, we said we had a notion of curvature, because whereas a pair of partial derivatives always commute with one another, a pair of covariant derivatives do not. And so we introduced the Riemann curvature by saying that it measures the degree to which the commutator of two covariant derivatives fails to commute when acting on a vector. And then finally, in step three, we introduce the metric. The metric is a rank two tensor. Rank 0, 2 tensor, I should say. It's symmetric, so it's basically a 2 by 2 symmetric matrix at every point on the manifold. And now it suddenly gives us a lot of the things that you really associate with geometry. It suddenly, given the metric, I can take each little infinitesimal element dx along this curve and convert it into an actual length and compute the total length of the curve by integrating up those infinitesimal lengths along the curve. I can write down a notion of scalar curvature, R, which is I take g beta delta and contract it with the Riemann curvature tensor, which again I also have appropriately contracted. So I've taken my four index Riemann tensor, contracted these two indices, gotten the Ricci tensor, and then I take the remaining two indices, contract them with this guy. Now I have no more free indices. So this is, for the first time, a scalar coordinate invariant notion of curvature on the manifold. We had a new definition of geodesics, which was the paths that pads that were stationary points of had stationary length. So under infinitesimal variations of the path, the length of the path didn't vary to first order in that variation. And we said that as long as we took the preferred connection, once we've introduced a metric, there's a natural choice for the connection as well that's compatible with that metric. That compatibility condition is just that the metric be everywhere its covariant derivative in any direction be zero. The covariant derivative of the metric is everywhere zero. That turns out to imply that the, as you'll derive in the tutorial this afternoon, that implies a unique form for the connection, the so-called Levi-Civita connection, or also known as the Christoffel symbol, which has this famous form. Yeah, and we said, well, if you take this preferred connection, which you do in general relativity, then these two notions of geodesic, a stationary point of the length or a curve which parallel transports its own tangent vector, those two things are equivalent. And that's everything you should know about differential geometry. If anybody tells you otherwise, they're just trying to tell you things. Yeah.
Without any notion of the distance between two points?
I mean, yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question. So you have to, so partial derivative is defined once you put coordinates down. So in other words, I have my manifold here. And let's say that above the manifold, I have some particular function, functional form. So, you know, above this point, it has the value 2, and above this point, it has the value 2.1, 2.1.9, you know. It has different values that live above these points on the manifold. That's true before I lay down any coordinates. But its partial derivatives near this point are not defined until I lay down some coordinates. But now let me say, okay, so now let me lay down coordinates so that, okay. So for example, to be concrete, imagine I have a function, its value is 2 here, 2 here, 2 here, 2.1 here, 1.9 here. And then I'm free to choose whatever coordinates I want, but I happen to choose coordinates that, where the x coordinates are like this in the vicinity of this point, and the y coordinates are like this. Now when I choose a partial, now the partial derivative is defined. Because the y coordinate, let's say, makes a step of, its value was 0 here, 1, 2, da da da. And so the partial derivative of f in the y direction here is 2 minus 2 divided by 1. So it's 0. Whereas in this direction, it's 2 minus 1.9. And if the x coordinate is 0, 1, if I've chosen coordinates like that, so that's 2 minus 1.9 is 0.1. Divided by 1 is 0.1. So it has a partial derivative of 0.1 in the x direction in this particular coordinate system, partial derivative of 0 in the y direction. So I don't need a metric yet to define a partial derivative. I just need, because all a partial derivative means is how fast is the function changing with respect to whatever coordinates I lay down. But maybe what you're saying is that so the partial derivative will be different. It will not have an invariant meaning when I change coordinates. So that's the thing. In general, the partial derivative, well, of a scalar function, it does transform like a tensor. But in general, I think maybe what you're saying is that's right. The partial derivative does not have a tensorial meaning. Does not have a good geometric meaning. If all I have are coordinates on the system, that's why I had to introduce a connection on the manifold to get a new derivative operator that did make sense, that did somehow mean the same thing in different coordinates. I don't know. Was that clear? I fear that wasn't clear. I also fear that I'm going to do a bad job of doing anything clearer than that, though. So,
I will think about it later.
Okay. I mean, yeah. Let's talk about it after class. Let's. Okay. So let's see. I think that's it. So now I was going to go ahead, and you know what? Enough of this board. Why waste time on a dirty board when I have like eight boards and robots will move them around for me? Okay.
Latham, when you talked about the parallel transport map, that's only unique infinitesimally, right? Because if you take two points that are far away, it depends which path you parallel transport.
That's right. Parallel transport is only defined if you take two points and give a curve.
No, but I mean the map that you get from one tangent space to the other, that's not unique. It depends
on the curve. Exactly. Yes, yes. Yes, that's absolutely right. So that's right. So when I say you need two points and a curve, what Siavash is stressing is, I should have said, is absolutely true. So two points and a curve define a correspondence between these two tangent spaces. So suddenly for every vector here, there's a vector over here that's parallel to it. But that map will be different if I choose a different curve. That's absolutely right. Yeah. And the degree to which that map is different, is another way to measure the curvature of the manifold.
Would it be different if you choose the same image of the curve, but a different curve with the same image?
Same image of the curve?
Like different parameterization, for example.
Oh, no. So everything is set up so that if you take the same two points on the manifold and the same curve across the manifold, then any coordinates that you describe that in, the parallel transport map between the two spaces is the same. You may just, in other words, there's some vector here, and there's some vector here, that once I put down a connection on this manifold, and this is some point P that doesn't change, and this is some point P prime that doesn't change, and this is some curve gamma that doesn't change, then this vector is parallel to this vector. But things will look different in different coordinate systems. So in one coordinate system, I will call this point P by the coordinate X sub P, and I will call this by the coordinate X sub P prime. And this vector will have components that look like that are some components V alpha sub P, and this guy will have some components V alpha sub P prime. And then if I take a new coordinate system, I'll now call this point by a different name in terms of coordinates. I'll call it X twiddle sub P, and I'll call this guy X twiddle sub P prime. And these guys will have different coordinates. They will have coordinates V twiddle sub P and V twiddle sub P prime. But these coordinates will be related to these guys by the tensor transformation law at this point P, and these guys will be related by the tensor transformation law at this other point. So in other words, things may look superficially different in different coordinate systems, but ultimately it's defining the same map in the sense that if two vectors are related by the tensor transformation law here, and you can either parallel transport and then map to the other coordinate system, or map to the other coordinate system and parallel transport, and you'll get the same V twiddle vector at the end, is another way to say it. It all sounds confusing when it comes out of my mouth. I don't know what to say. It's disappointing by how it comes out. But this is kind of going to be a theme. I'm going to be disappointed with how the answer sounds, but then convinced that I can't do any better, and so then we'll just have to move on and be all disappointed. Okay. So I was just going to do, as I say, I was going to sort of walk through the steps now to the GR action, the so-called Einstein-Hilbert action for general relativity, and the action for Yang-Mills theory in parallel, just to see the similarities between the two. So the starting point. So over here we start with some vector, a contravariant vector, and it transforms like a contravariant vector, meaning under a coordinate transformation from x coordinates to x twiddle coordinates, its components transform to v twiddle according to the standard tensor transformation law. So the analog of that is that in Yang-Mills theory, let's say I have SUN Yang-Mills theory or UN Yang-Mills theory. So an example of an object that appears in general relativity is a vector, a contravariant vector. The analogous object that appears in Yang-Mills theory is a vector of n fields. Oh, so let me call this. Let's say this is an m-dimensional manifold, little m. So this is a vector with m components. And then let's talk about SUN, just for concreteness, Yang-Mills theory, or UN Yang-Mills theory. And so we have, let's say, capital N scalar fields. We have a vector, a multiplet of n scalar fields. So A runs from, I'll use Greek indices for space-time coordinates. So here I guess the Greek indices run from 0 to m minus 1. And here I'll use Latin indices for Yang-Mills theory. So these guys run from 1 up to capital N. And so in other words, in this picture, now we have on our manifold, you know, at each point we have the tangent space, the space of all tangent vectors to the manifold at that point. Okay, and those guys have Greek indices. But then we also have another space. We have a vector space of scalar fields or a vector space of fermionic fields, an n-dimensional, capital N-dimensional vector space that doesn't get transformed by a coordinate transformation, but does get transformed by a gauge transformation. So we have this tangent space at any given point, and the collection of all the different tangent spaces over the manifold. There's a different tangent space at every point. The collection of all those tangent spaces is called the tangent bundle, and in that lingo, gamma. Basically, our Christoffel symbol is the connection on the tangent bundle. But then there's also, at every point, an n-dimensional vector space that gets operated on by this un, by gauge transformations. And the collection of all the different vectors, of all the different of those capital n-dimensional vector spaces over the manifold is called the gauge bundle. And the Yang-Mills field A, the vector field A, this guy is going to be the connection on the gauge bundle. So let's just see what that means first. So that's what I'm trying. So under a gauge transformation, just like in general relativity, I can make a coordinate transformation, and it can vary from point to point. So this matrix, this is some matrix with two indices, alpha and beta. That describes the coordinate transformation at every point, and that matrix can vary arbitrarily from point to point in general relativity. I can make a different coordinate transformation at every different point on the manifold, or I mean I can choose my coordinate transformation arbitrarily so that this matrix is different from every point on the manifold. Analogously, in gauge theory, the idea is I can choose a different unitary matrix at every point on the manifold, a different n by n unitary matrix on the manifold, and at that point. The fields that are operated on the matter fields that are operated on by that UN matrix transform as follows. They just get acted on by the unitary matrix at that point. Okay, so in other words, this matrix UAB is directly analogous to this partial derivative matrix. Okay, And so now, you know, the way we introduced the connection over here is we wanted to introduce a
What? Sorry, say it again.
You're just saying that when you act with the unit in a matrix, the field doesn't change at all. That's it.
You know what? I think maybe let me. So I have. I think I should have to be analogous over here. So I start with this. Now, what I mean by this is that here I have n scalar fields, so capital N different scalar fields, each of which varies over the manifold. But at any given point, it's just a vector of n numbers. At that point, I choose a unitary matrix, and it outputs, after I choose that matrix, that corresponds to choosing the gauge transformation at that point, I get a new vector of n numbers at that point, which is the unitary matrix at that point times the old vector of numbers at that point. Okay? Just like the coordinates of this vector were over here, I shouldn't label it by coordinates because they change when I do the transformation. Let me label it by the point P. The coordinates at this point P on the manifold, and then I make a coordinate transformation here, the components at the same point P in the new coordinates are obtained from the components in the old coordinate system by multiplying by this transformation. Okay, and so now over here, we said if we just take a derivative of V, we would have liked, this looks like it has one upper index and one lower index. It would be nice if this thing transformed like a rank 1-1 tensor. But does it? No. Under a coordinate transformation, it transforms to delta twiddle v twiddle, but then if we plug in what these things are, well, by the chain rule, this thing becomes that, and by the tensor transformation law, this thing becomes and then when we expand this out, we get two terms here. We get one term from when this partial acts on this first factor, and one term when it acts on the second factor. So the term where it acts on the second factor, if that was all there was, that would be great. Then the thing would be a tensor. But the term in which this derivative acts on this guy spoils the tensor transformation law, and so. So we were led to instead introduce a covariant derivative, which acts as follows. And then we chose the transformation law. So far this guy has no meaning, but we're going to define this thing by saying that it will transform however it needs to so that this thing transforms like a tensor of rank 1-1. So in other words, we want it to be true that under a coordinate transformation, the components of this rank 1-1 tensor become okay, we want it to transform like that, And so we can ask ourselves, how does this guy need to transform in order for that to be the case? And this actually is related to there was this question of a sign last time. So what we find here is that this guy has to transform like. So in fact, this was when I was checking this sign after class, it was actually such a good exercise that So it's another thing that's going to be in the tutorial. But the bottom line is that there's really two equivalent expressions, one with a plus sign and one with a minus sign. So the transformation law is gamma twiddle. Okay, there's the first term that's just the normal tensor transformation law. It's the term that is proportional to gamma. Okay, this is very schematic, but you know what I mean. There's three factors here, three partial derivative factors that are appropriate for transforming these three indices. And then there's an extra term, which you can either write or there's an equivalent one. There's an equivalent version that has the same tensor piece, and then the other term looks like see the meaning of these two different versions in a second. So you see that there's two versions that look different but turn out to be totally equivalent. And that in this form this should be with a plus sign, in this form this should be with a minus sign. And you'll see they vary in terms of where the second derivative is and which terms have twiddles in the numerator and which terms have them in the denominator. But this is one of the things that this is actually a good exercise to understand exactly what. Make sure you know what you're doing. This is more involves more thought than the standard tensor manipulation. But so let's see. Everything is a little bit easier on this side. So these guys are often the derivations on this side they're not hard. They're just a little bit too gross for me to do in class. So I've dumped them into the tutorial where, because if I do it on the board, everyone will just kill themselves. But these guys are simple enough that we can do them on the board, and then you can see how these things are going to go. So what is the analog of this story? Well, so again, over here, if we take a partial derivative of phi, an ordinary partial derivative, and ask how it transforms. Well, what we want, so this guy has one Greek index, coordinate index, and one Latin index. So let's just forget about coordinate transformations for a second. Let's just do a gauge transformation. What we want is for this thing to transform. It has only one gauge index, only one Latin index, and it's an upper index. So we want it to transform just like the original vector did with one factor of u. Under a gauge transformation, but it doesn't do that. Instead, it becomes phi twiddle of a. But phi twiddle of a is just this thing. And so the derivative gives two terms here. The first term is okay. So if that was all there was, that's exactly the would be a that would correspond to this thing transforming like a vector under the gauge transformation. But then there's this other term coming from the derivative acting on this first factor. So again, we don't want that. So we're led to introduce a covariant derivative, which acts like this. And so before we go on, let's just see that we're supposed to be comparing this expression to this expression. So don't worry about the IG here. This is just a matter of the fact that there's an I here and not here, that's just a matter of that happens to be typical physicist's convention. The conventions were all laid down before the parallelism between these two things was widely understood. So A, if you compare the connection on the gauge bundle A to the connection on the tangent bundle gamma, what you see is, well, it has one lower index corresponding to the direction in which you're taking the derivative. And similarly here, there's one lower index corresponding to the direction in which you're taking the derivative. But then the idea is that for every value of mu, this thing is a matrix with a 2x2 matrix with both indices living in the tangent bundle, whereas this is for a given value of mu, it has indices alpha and beta. It has two. It's a two index tensor. It's a matrix with two indices that operates in the tangent bundle. So somehow this is for every value of mu, this matrix with indices alpha and beta is performing a little extra rotation in the tangent bundle to cancel off this spoiler. Where did it go? To cancel off the extra term that spoiled the tensorial the tensor nature of this transformation law. And similarly, for every value of mu, this is a matrix with indices a b that performs a little extra rotation on this vector in the tangent bundle to cancel off this extra piece that was spoiling the tensorial nature of this transformation law. And so, like as with everything, it's easier on this side to derive exactly what the transformation law for A should be. So what we want is we want that under a transformation, under a gauge transformation that takes us to the twiddle frame, we want this to be to transform like a tensor, in other words, like so. Okay, and so that means that, well, on this side, if we expand this guy out, have I done this correctly so far? Yeah. Well, let me do this a little bit more. Let me do this in a slightly neater way. Okay, so Okay, so if you just expand out the definition of the covariant derivative on both sides in terms of the partial derivative and the connection, you get these two expressions. Okay, and now let me just sketch where the rest will go. So what will happen if I plug in? If I now plug in for phi twiddle in both of these places, the expression u phi. I plug in this transformation law. Phi twiddle is equal to u phi. Here the derivative will act on this product to get. You know what? I should do it explicitly. I'm always tempted to be lazy, but if I plug in this tensor transformation law here, I get d mu uab times phi b plus the term where the d mu acts on phi b, so uab d mu phi b. Plus IG A mu twiddle AB U BC phi C. Okay, and so then this is the expanded out version of the left hand side. I don't know, this may be getting hard to see. Oh boy, that's a bad idea. Okay, I'm ruining it. Can anyone read that? Is that legible or illegible? It's illegible. No response means it's illegible. That's just politeness. Okay, so if you could read this, you would see that this term is exactly the same as this term. So these two terms cancel. Oops. Okay, so I'm left with one term on the right-hand side, which is u times IGA phi C. And then I'm left with two terms on the left-hand side, which are both, neither of which involves a derivative of phi, okay? So let me first of all change this index so that it says, so that it's a C. And then, okay, so now, now every term on both sides is proportional to phi sub c, and it has to be the expression has to be true. The idea is that the transformation law is supposed to hold for any phi c that I choose. So in other words, it's really the coefficients. The equation has to hold for the coefficients that are multiplying phi sub c. So in other words, to simplify, so what this equation is really saying now is that d mu uac plus ig a mu twiddle ab ubc is equal to ig uab a mu BC. Okay, and now you may think I'm being very pedantic about keeping all the Latin indices showing, and you're absolutely right. It's increasingly clear that it's just wasting effort to keep all the indices showing. So let's just write this in matrix notation, only leaving the Greek indices explicit. So this says d mu u is equal to IG A twiddle mu u, which is, oh, whoops, u mu plus ig is equal to ig u a mu. So anyway, let me just subtract this term. Okay, and divide by ig. And then finally, let me multiply on the right-hand side by U inverse to get rid of that U. And I end up with the final expression for the transformation law. A mu twiddle is equal to U, A mu U inverse plus I over G D mu U times U inverse. Okay, and then, so that's one version of the expression. That's this guy is analogous to the version of the gamma transformation law with the plus sign here. The version with the minus sign is, in this language, is comes from nothing but the statement that, well, U times U inverse is by definition always one. So if I take d mu of both sides here, if I take d mu of both sides, then on this side I get two terms. And on the other side is just always zero. So that means that that means I can add zero, or I can subtract zero from the right-hand side of that expression, but write zero in this form, okay, or subtract I over G times this, and convert this into, okay, the same first term, and then minus IG U D mu U inverse. Okay, so anyway, so you see that there's two equivalent expressions that come with a plus and a minus sign for the transformation law of the connection over here. And they're, you can think about this in the tutorial, they're really very closely analogous to these two expressions in the transformation law for gamma. Okay. Okay, so far we have we've gone through the parallelism on both sides. We've introduced a connection on the tangent bundle and on the gauge bundle, and we've found the transformation laws in both cases so that we can introduce a space-time covariant derivative or a gauge covariant derivative in both cases that transforms like a tensor, either under coordinate transformations or gauge transformations. So now let's continue. On the GR side, once we had a connection, the next thing we did was define the curvature by the commutator of two partial derivatives, by the commutator of two covariant derivatives. Their failure to commute was measured the curvature of the connection. So we said V sub alpha was equal to, that was the definition of the Riemann curvature of the connection. So similarly over here, the failure of two gauge covariant derivatives to commute gives the Riemann curvature of the gauge connection, or the curvature of the gauge connection, let's say. Okay, and again, conventionally there's an extra factor of IG, but don't worry about that. Okay, so that there are these almost exactly analogous formulae, except, you know, because in this case, the derivatives have space-time indices, and the vector being acted on has a space-time index. All four of the indices on the Riemann tensor are space-time indices, whereas in the Yang-Mills case, the derivatives have space-time indices, but the object being acted on is a field whose index lives in the tangent in the gauge bundle. So now we end up with a curvature tensor who has two space-time indices, but two gauge indices. And so you're more familiar with just seeing this thing probably with just its two space-time indices displayed. This is the Yang-Mills field strength. So the Yang-Mills field strength, in other words, the Yang-Mills generalization of the electromagnetic field strength, is nothing but the curvature of the Yang-Mills connection on the gauge bundle, the curvature of the connection A mu. So these extra indices are just reminding you that, you know, usually you might see F written with just its space-time indices showing, but you have to remember this is also a 2x2, not a 2x, I keep saying that. This is also a matrix, an n by n matrix. That acts in the gauge bundle. Okay, and so again, just as it was over here, if you just take these covariant derivatives and write them out as partial derivative plus Christoffel symbol, this implies this leads to an expression for the Riemann curvature tensor in terms of the Christoffel symbols. So just for reference in a moment, I'm just going to write it down. So similarly, as in all of these calculations, the calculation on this side is just a little bit easier to do. And so I'm not going to do the full calculation, but I'm just going to sketch how the calculation of the analogous formula. So here we calculated the Riemann curvature in terms of the Christoffel symbols, in terms of the connection on the tangent bundle. Here we want to find that the familiar formula for the Yang-Mills field strength F, in terms of the, you know, there's some formula like F mu nu is equal to we want to find that this familiar formula for the Yang-Mills field strength in terms of the Yang-Mills gauge fields is nothing but the formula for the curvature that's exactly analogous to this, that it comes out of the analogous calculation on this side. So let's just sketch that. Okay, let's just consider one term here. And first let's expand out the first covariant derivative, d sub gamma. So this is a covariant derivative acting on this looks like a tensor with two indices, but this is a gauge covariant derivative, and this only has one gauge index. So it's really just a covariant derivative acting on a vector in the gauge bundle. It only has one gauge index, one upper gauge index. So, in other words, we get one term like that, and one term like this. Okay, now we expand out the other covariant derivative. It's later than I thought it was. Okay, so now what will happen? So now we're supposed to take this expression and then subtract from it the same expression, but with gamma and delta switched. So what will happen? Well, this term will get killed. Basically, if you write down this expression, you subtract from it the same expression with delta and gamma switched, the first thing you find is that every term in this expression in which phi is acted on by a derivative cancels when you subtract the two antisymmetrized terms. So you're only left with terms that are proportional to phi, not to the derivative of phi. Okay, and you're just left with four of those terms. And if you just collect those terms, I mean, I think this is enough to see how the calculation goes, but I recommend checking this at least once in your life on your own. If you just subtract the anti-symmetrized term in gamma and delta from this guy, you'll find exactly the expression that we just said, and you compare with this formula, you find that F AB gamma delta, let me again suppress, for simplicity, suppress these two gauge indices. F gamma delta is equal to okay, and just remember that if we really were showing all the indices, A would have one spacetime index, which we're showing, but then it's also a matrix with two indices in the gauge bundle, and we're just suppressing those indices and writing it in matrix form. But so this is the commutator of two n by n matrices, so that's an n by n matrix. These are derivatives of an n by n matrix, so those are n by n matrices. So F is also an n by n matrix, which again, it really has these other two indices running from 1 to n. We've just suppressed them. Okay, so the final step. So far everything has been completely parallel, and now we're actually just 2 minutes from the end, we're 2 minutes from the end of what we'll actually get to. So now we're ready to write down. So from the standpoint of writing down a physical theory, from the modern standpoint, if you want to write down a theory, you need to write down its action. And to write down its action, you want to write down the integral over spacetime of some Lagrange density that is a scalar. That is a scalar under everything. It's a scalar under all of the things that are supposed to be symmetries of the theory. So in this case, we want it to be a scalar under coordinate transformations, because that's supposed to be the basic symmetry of general relativity. In this case, we want it to be a scalar both under coordinate transformations and under gauge transformations, because those are supposed to be the symmetries of Yang-Mills theory. Basically, that means, you know, to make sure it's a scalar, we have to make sure that all of the indices, there are no free indices hanging around. We have to construct something where all of the indices have been contracted with other indices so that at the end of the day, there are no extra either space-time or gauge indices hanging around. So what is the simplest thing we can construct on this side? Where did I put my chalk? Well, the simplest thing we can do, so we went to all this trouble to first take our, we were led to introduce a field, a connection in both cases, and that connection, we would like to have that be somehow our dynamical variable, but at first it's not a tensor. At first it doesn't transform tensorially. So we went to all this trouble to define the curvature because the curvature does transform tensorially. The curvature is a, you know, we've converted this gamma, which is a messy thing that's not a tensor, via this formula into something that is a tensor. And similarly, we've taken A, which is not a tensor, and by defining the curvature, we've ended up with a quantity that does transform tensorially. And so now we're really ready to try to figure out what is the simplest way to take these tensorial objects and contract up their indices to get the simplest scalar we can think of. So over here, the simplest scalar is to just have one power of the curvature. So we saw before that the first thing we can do is we can contract these two indices, alpha and gamma, to get the Ricci tensor. And then, once we've done that, we can just take these two indices and contract them to get the Ricci scalar. And good, we're done. We've succeeded in getting. We introduced the connection, and then we succeeded at the end of the day constructing an object that was a scalar under coordinate transformations from that connection, or from the metric in connection. So this is exactly what we will take as our action in general relativity, or I should say the action is proportional to this. The actual Einstein-Hilbert action is there's a proportionality constant, 1 over 16 pi g newton, and then you have to take that Lagrange density and integrate it over space. So what about on this side? Well, so life is not so. So suddenly the parallelism breaks down, because the first step over here was to take the curvature and contract these two indices. But you know, here we can't do this because these two indices live in different vector spaces. This guy lives in the gauge bundle. This guy lives in the tangent bundle. So we can't contract those. And furthermore, by construction, so what can we do? Let's first think about how we can get rid of the space-time indices, how we can make a scalar. Well, by construction, you can see here, by the definition of F, it's clearly anti-symmetric under changing gamma and delta. So what we cannot do is just contract gamma and delta with the metric, because the metric is symmetric in gamma and delta. And so if we contract a symmetric thing with an anti-symmetric thing, the answer will just be 0. So we're forced to take two copies of F, okay, gamma delta and F alpha beta. And now we have enough freedom that if we, as long as we don't contract these two guys together or these two guys together, we can make a contraction that doesn't vanish. So in other words, we have to contract one guy from here with one guy from here, and one guy from here with one guy from here. So we multiply by g gamma delta, g gamma alpha, g delta beta. So that works. So in other words, that's, in simpler terms, that's just f alpha beta, f alpha beta. Okay, so we've taken care of the, can you see this? This is blocked, isn't it? Can you guys see these indices? Not really. So just the, whoops. So the simplest thing we can write down is the Lorentz scalar is like this. But now, remember, this was still a 2x2 matrix in terms of its gauge indices. This was still an n by n matrix in terms of its gauge indices. So this product is still an n by n matrix with, you know, so this had upper, let's say, upper C, lower D, upper D, lower E. So in other words, it still has gauge indices, A and B. And so to make a thing that is also a gauge, a scalar under the gauge group, invariant under the gauge group, we now just set these things. We can contract these two indices. These guys. We can just go ahead and contract. And so in other words, we take the trace of this object. We take the trace over the gauge indices of this thing. That's the simplest thing we can. That's the simplest object we can construct that has no free hanging indices. And again, this is exactly the Yang-Mills action. So, or in other words, -1/4 times this is the action for Yang-Mills theory. So. Yeah. Anyway, I hope the point is clear that the construction of the two theories is almost perfectly parallel until this final step, where you're forced to take an object that's quadratic in curvature in the Yang-Mills case, whereas you could get away with an object that's linear in the curvature in the GR case. And then I was hoping to say a little bit more about how to derive Einstein's equations from from that action, but at least part of that will be covered in the tutorial, and I may, well, I don't know, I may go back and treat that at the beginning of the next lecture, but so I may or may not do that. I have to think about it. But anyway, that modulo, that comment, that completes the review of general relativity. It was, you know, as I say, it was a very concise review. But so starting on Thursday, we'll meet all of the coolest solutions of general relativity. And then on Friday, we'll finally really focus on the solution of greatest interest to cosmology, the family of Friedman, Robertson, Walker metrics. Okay?